The following may contain offensive language, adult humor, and or content that some viewers may find offensive. The views and opinions expressed by any one speaker does not explicitly or necessarily reflect or represent those of Mark Rattledge or W2M Network. Please listen with caution, or don't listen at all.
Welcome to On Trial, starring Mark Rattledge, also starring Sean Comer. Hope you're ready, Hollywood, because you're on trial.
All rise. Court is now in session. The Honorable Judge Fudge presiding. This is On Trial, a podcast from the Rattledge and Broadcasting Network, where we debate the merits, Lincoln Douglas style, of your favorite movies of yore. Tonight, once again, I am in the unfortunate role of prosecuting attorney. And on the docket is Josie and the Pussycats, long hair, there's a fly, guitars, and sharp.
Which is why we have our mascot with us tonight.
That's right. Is that Josie?
She will fill in the role of Josie tonight, won't you, Val?
Perfect. Josie and the Pussycats is a 2001 satirical, I want to emphasize satirical, musical comedy film co-produced by Universal Pictures and Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Rawr, speaking of Pussycats. Directed and co-written by Harry Alfont and Deborah Kaplan, the film is based on both the Archie comic series and the Hanna-Barbera cartoon of the same name, filmed entirely in Vancouver, Canada. The film features Rachel Lee Cook, Tara Reid, and Rosario Dawson as the Pussycats, with Alan Cumming, Parker Posey, Gabriel Mann, Paula Costanzo, and Missy Pyle in supporting roles. Although the film soundtrack was well-received, charting at, I mean, really, can you go wrong with Biff Naked and the chick from Letters to Cleo? At number 16 on the Billboard 200 and quickly achieving gold status. The film itself received mixed reviews and was a commercial failure upon its initial release. However, it has enjoyed later success as a cult film. And in for the defense, ladies and gentlemen, is my brother from another mother, the boxing aficionado, the punchy pugilist, Mr. Toxic Masculinity, and we love him for it. Ladies and gentlemen, Pat Mullen, how do you do, hardcore?
And knowing I was going to be on trial tonight and what we use for theme music, I even cut my hair like Richard Mall as Bull.
Oh, perfect. So this was meant to be a quick How the Sausage is Made. This was meant to be a triple feature. And this was kind of like the School's in Trouble triple feature, where we're having a conversation in our chat. And, you know, it's like we're on meth. Like, Pat and I will just start talking. Like, we should do this, we should do that. So the funny thing about this was, I was going to do like Josie, the Flintstones, and something else. Cause again, we were talking about comic podcasts, comic adaptations. And I threw out Josie and the Pussycats. And Pat was like, yeah, I'm in on this one. And shoved the entire Rattledge and Broadcasting Network into the pool, like at once. It was like a domino effect. Like everyone just fell over Alexis Haina and they all piled into the pool. And Pat's suggestion originally was Josie and the Pussycats, Spice World, and Satisfaction with Justine Bateman. And unfortunately, two of those movies are not available anywhere, Pat.
Which is crazy. I can't believe that.
It is weird what's not on streaming services, because like even with the free ones like Tubi or something, you know, or like Hoopla, which is
Pluto, nothing.
Yeah. I was like, how do you like it's just so cheap to kind of have some of these things. I don't understand like why I can't find Spice World of all things.
Yeah, like I remember I had Spice World on VHS.
Sure.
Sadly, I don't anymore. But you know, I the fact that that was unavailable, but even Satisfaction, which a lot of people look to because Julia Roberts, it's basically her first real big role.
I thought Mystic Pizza was.
I think Satisfaction predates Mystic Pizza, actually.
Okay.
But I believe it's her first like big lead film role is in Satisfaction. also featuring one of the first big roles of Liam Neeson's career.
Oh, wow.
See, that would've been fun to talk about. Manager in it.
Yeah, that would have been fun to talk about. So, yeah, we were going to do a triple feature of just girl band movies.
Yeah, which would have been great.
And then we couldn't find Spice World. I was like, well, we can pivot. And I think I was going to suggest to you The Runaways or something. And you're like, no, I'm going to find these. I'm thinking I'm going to get... Yeah, what did you do exactly? Did you try to get someone to get this on Plex or something?
I took a flight to the UK. I threatened Julia Roberts with legal action. I told her I would find out that we actually had baby pictures of her, that her teeth were the same size when she was a baby. And I said we were going to get Eric back in the limelight, and it was a whole thing, and nothing. I couldn't get anything done. I'm really disappointed in myself, honestly.
Right. So I think at that point, like, I was going to suggest, like I said, The Runaways and maybe something else. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's just talk. Let's just have fun, Pat. This is 2024 is the year the men have fun.
That's right.
On the Rattle Engine Broadcasting Network. So we're going to talk Josie and the Pussycats tonight. And I got to ask, like I said, you don't participate in the chat except to shit on something. Or... blame some out of left field movie that everyone else wanted to do, and it's like, and suddenly you wake up and it's just like this obscure weirdo thing. Yes, I'm all. So, why Josie and the Pussycats, Pat? Why?
I love this movie. This is a fantastic movie. Mm-hmm. It's very meta and very self-aware, and it's fun to look back at this time period where it's very. What's the word I'm looking for? Where it's very apropos of the time it's set in.
Oh my God. And yeah, it is definitely a window into 2001.
Oh, so much. And, mm-hmm. you know, having lived through that during my formative years.
So you were 15, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, you know, a fun time where a lot of stuff goes on in your life. And,
you know. I figured that out because that's actually part of my prosecution is I was 25 when this came out in 2001. Which would have made you about 15. I remembered you're about 10 years younger than me. And I thought, like, okay, so for the early 20-year-olds, mid-20-year-olds to like the mid-teenage of 15-year-olds, I'm like, yeah, like if you're gearing it towards them, what an audience you have. They weren't. They were gearing it towards like tween girls. Yeah. And that is a big part of what I'm gonna talk about in a little bit.
We honestly, when I was trying to pivot, man, we couldn't find those movies. One of the other ones I thought of putting in here was Gem. But again, another, you know, girl rock band based on, you know, a cartoon.
I've already done that.
I remembered, that was already a thing you did, and I didn't want to make you have to live through it again.
Oh, I appreciate that. Also, you know, I have a no repeats rule, Evan Bevins. I've done 8 of those movies, but Evan, shut up. or my other favorite one, we should do this. I've already done that, Alexis. Pay attention to something that you're not on. Long story short, so Josie and the Pussycats were characters in the Archie comics, and then they had their own cartoon. I watched the cartoon, not like religiously or anything. I'm aware of it. I know the theme. And I watched it as a kid. My Hanna-Barbera television watching is very hit or miss. Like, the funny thing about me thinking about this movie and what I wanted to say about it and what I want to talk to my good friend Pat Mullen about it, I was thinking about all the Hanna-Barbera stuff I did watch. And you know what I have, like, the most visceral memory of besides Wacky Races? Jabba Jaws.
Really?
Oh, my God. I remember I'm walking around work today going, jab, 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 Jabba Jaws, Jabba Jaws. He's the greatest shark you ever saw. You ever saw? The fucking shark is like mimicking Curly from the Three Stooges.
He's doing the Curly shuffle but swimming.
Yuck, yuck, yuck. So good. But yeah, I mean, I watched some Yogi and I watched some Josie and the Pussycats and, you know, a variety of the stuff out of that cartoon house. How about you? Tell me about your Josie and the Pussycat watching.
So it was, again, the age discrepancy between us. Mm-hmm. Cartoon Network was a big thing in the early 90s if you had the cable. And at one point, we got my cheapskate dad to get the cable. Mm-hmm. And there was a TV station that had nothing but cartoons on for, you know, like 6-year-old me.
Did he make you climb up on the roof with rabbit ears so we could watch the game?
Let's not get into that now.
I was on the roof for a different reason.
Yeah. But Sam's?
You're going to kill yourself.
But yeah, so that a lot of the stuff that they would play was, you know, Hanna-Barbera catalog, you know, Ruby Spears catalog. So yeah. Josie and the Pussycats was one of those shows that they always had on at various times of day because they were able to purchase that library and have it running.
Right.
And so even though it wasn't, you know, a normal regular Saturday morning cartoon for me in the era I was in, I'm pretty sure by the time like it had first started airing on Cartoon Network, because I think there's only like 30 episodes to it. It had a short run.
I was going to say it ran for 2 years, but like I would have to look and see exactly how many individual episodes it was. It probably wasn't much.
Yeah, because I feel like I had seen all of them within the span of a couple months, and then they just kept looping back around. But yeah, I remember the show, and it was funny to me as a kid. It was, you know, it was like watching Scooby-Doo, but with the element of, you know.
I was going to say, like, weren't they like a mystery solving rock band trio? Like, that was essentially the central premise of the show was there's foul play afoot.
Yeah.
And these three dames are on the case, and occasionally they break to play music.
Right, along with Alan, Alex, and Alexandra, and the cat, right. Sebastian, who unfortunately did not make it into the movie, but.
Oh, it really should have, though.
But still, and again, the Scooby-Doo connection, Casey Kasem doing another voice in this cartoon, too, is as Alex.
Excellent. I saw this when it came out many, many moons ago, you know, in 2001. I don't think, and then I think a couple of years ago, when Lily started becoming very vocal about her opinions on gender roles. Shut up. Leave my daughter alone, you bully. At least wait till she's 18 and you can bully her all you want.
Love your son, by the way.
Yeah, he's awesome. So is my daughter. So anyway, I showed her this movie. She thought it was hysterical. It's a very, I think it's one of the few movies I've seen where they were going for girl power and they went for it while maintaining a sense of femininity. Like, you know, not everyone here in the movie is the way women are written now, which is very two-dimensional and everyone's a girl boss and they're totally flawless and like the Rey model from the Star Wars, the new Star Wars trilogy. Like, these women seem like people. I mean, Tara Reid's more of a toaster oven, but the other two, Rosario Dawson and Rachel Lee Cook, actually feel like people in this movie. So it was a fun one to show her, and it definitely resonated.
Yeah, and they don't do it at the expense, really, of other characters, particularly the male ones. Right.
This is back when they used to write men and women as equals, which was nice.
Yeah, you're not defined by how much better you are than the other gender at this or that or whatever. It's right. You know, you can be competent at a lot of things, and it doesn't have to minimize the other, you know, gender across the street. you know, they really do. Again, it's very meta. It's very self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
They really do a good job of outlining the strength, intelligence, and, you know, competence of the female leads. Again, particularly, you know, Rosario Dawson and Rachel Lee Cook. Yeah. Tara Reid plays the crap out of Melody. She plays Melody perfect, especially.
I was going to say, yeah, she's spot on as Melody.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that Melody was not the brains of the outfit. Melody was there for comic relief. You know, this is the Three Stooges. And Rachel, speaking of which, so Rachel Lee Cook and Rosario Dawson are Moe and Larry, and Tara Reid is Curly.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. Between Josie, Val, and Melody, that's perfectly how they break down. Yeah. but yeah, again, and I like that too. They're not, you know, yes, Melody is comic relief and that, but also Josie and Val are very different characters. Neither one, you know, shortchanging the other in any way or not defining them. They're defined characters. They have actual traits and things about them. You know, Val is very inquisitive and common sense. You know, Josie has mechanical ability, as we find out at the start of the film, and is very driven and smart. Yeah. And, you know, they all have things that play off each other while not being not stereotypes so much, but more like, what's the word I'm looking for here, Mark?
They're not pigeonholed into a specific type.
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you a question before we get into, because I don't think there's many more notes on this. I mean, if I remember correctly, the production on this was, I thought this was interesting, Maggie Gyllenhaal and Zooey Deschanel both auditioned for the role, as did Beyoncé, Aaliyah, and Lisa Left Eye Lopez. Jesus Christ, so this is a blast from the past, huh?
Burning down the house.
Yes, sir. Yeah, there's not a whole lot here in the production notes, though. I think it was funny that they went with Kara Reid because they liked her a lot in the American Pie movies, which I'll bet you did, you saucy movie executives, you. How much of the movie do you think gets the source material correctly, whether it be the stuff from the Archie comics, the actual Josie and the Pussy comics, or the cartoon, in your opinion?
So, I didn't really read the Archie comics, I'm not going to lie.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The only Archie comics I really ever read were Archie, a couple of Jugheads.
Mm-hmm.
And once in a while, they'd put one out of Reggie, and I'd like to read that too, just for the heck of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't listen, really that, ain't no shame in my game. I haven't read a single Archie comic ever.
Yeah, I didn't really read, you know, the outside of Archie stuff like Sabrina or Josie and the Pussycats and that type of stuff, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. You know, but I did, you know, like I said, I grew up watching the cartoon, which to my understanding does present a pretty decent picture of what the comic book was.
Right.
If I'm wrong, someone can please correct me on that, but that's what I was made to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I think if that's the case, Tara Reid's Melody is pretty much... You could have ripped her off the comic pages or the cartoon,
right.
And she just nails this character perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that they are a band and stumble into this big thing that they have to fix and save the day with, again, yeah. Right out of that source material in that sense.
Yeah, I have some thoughts on that. But that'll be part of my prosecuting argument. So,
yeah.
All right. So the plot of this thing is really simple. I'm not going to read it off the Wikipedia page because, one, it stops the podcast dead. And, two, this isn't. You know, this is an Oppenheimer. I don't need to read the details. Essentially, the plot of this thing is we have an evil record executive who's using subliminal messages and music to control teenagers to make them spend money. It's not that hard of a concept. They were doing it with a boy band because that was a thing at the time, and they're called De Jure. And De Jure becomes suspicious of what's going on here. So they
kill him. I'm also waiting for Robert to step in and tell us the Simpsons did it first.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure he's listening. So anyway, they kill De Jure in a plane crash, and now the A&R guy has to find a new band, and he runs afoul of Josie and the Pussycats, who are just trying to make it their garage band. They're trying to gig around. You know, they're like Green Day before Dookie. And the A&R guy finds him. He's like, "You're pretty faces. This will do." And so he's like, "Here's a record contract." And immediately... They're like, "Wait a minute. Like, that's not how the record industry works." And he was like, "I understand, and you're not wrong, but you're pretty, and here's money. I don't see what the problem here is." And they go, "Fine." So they get in his black van and they speed away. Over the course of the movie, A&R guy is trying to isolate Josie from the other two girls, and eventually, you know, kind of like Belinda Carlisle and the Bengals. Like, listen, you're prettier than the other girls. Walk like an Egyptian over here and be a single star. And they use subliminal messaging again to get her to think that she does want a solo career. And Josie eventually figures out the plot of this whole thing. She figures out the shenanigans. And she goes to confront the record executive, who is Parker Posey. And says, "Hey, you've done a bad thing here, and I don't want you to do it anymore." And Parker Posey says, "But you don't understand." And Parker Posey's actually doing all of this in conjunction with the government officials. So anyway, they basically say, "Go out and perform for all these people who are going to hear my message. And this is a very important message. And it's a new message. And this message must be heard." And Josie says, "But no, I will not do it because I am the hero." And Parker Posey says, "But you will. Or we'll kill Melody and Rosario Valerie. Melody and Valerie. Tara Reid and Rosario Dawson. Yeah, so this is before Rosario Dawson was in Marvel movies, so she does not kick ass just yet. And so a fight happens, because now we get to the punchy part. And Rachel Lee Cook destroys the machine that was making the subliminal messages. And as it turns out, the subliminal message was, "Everyone will love Parker Posey." And then she did all of this so that people will like her and think she's cool. Because she had a lisp in high school, mm-hmm. And she wasn't cool, you see. And the A&R guy's like, "I went to high school with you. I'm an albino." Wonderful. And then the cops show up and arrest them. And the government shows up and says, "Hey, music's not really where it's at. Let's do subliminal messaging in movies." Wink. But then there's a concert to be had. So Josie and the Pussycats, minus the subliminal messaging, go out there and they perform a cross between Letters to Cleo and Biff Naked. And everyone loves them, because who doesn't love pop punk? I mean, really, who doesn't love pop punk? For God's sakes, Newfound Glory is still out there. It's still touring. Yes, I am aware. So anyway, and so everything's a big success, and they all live happily ever after. Here's my problem with this movie, Pat. Okay? I love this movie, don't get me wrong. But I want to read this to you, because it's because I read it and I laughed, and I read it and I laughed, and I thought, you know what, this right here sums up the problem. I gotta find the line here. So there's something along. I don't want to kill the podcast dead. So
no, you've built this up. This line has to be said in some manner, because I really want to hear it now. And so is everybody okay. Listening?
All right.
Because you can't just leave it hanging. Because again, you're saying you love this movie, but there's always a but with you, especially when you're the prosecutor. So I can't wait to hear it.
I had to put a but somewhere.
Yeah.
The critical reviews on this in the Wikipedia page are fucking hilarious. Oh, here it is. Okay. So this is in the commercial part. Kaplan and Elfont both later attributed the film's failure to their lack of consideration of the fact. And here's the rub. The fact that the film would be marketed to prepubescent girls. I don't know why we weren't thinking that based on the property, this like 100-year-old property that resonates with my age group and kind of Pat's age group, and anything under Pat you miss entirely, we kind of forgot that's who they were going to sell it to. But that's when the panic set in. They're not going to sell it to the people who are going to understand this movie, and the people they're selling it to aren't going to get it, and that's kind of what happened. And I think that's a brilliant point, that I think the movie does a fair job of adapting the source material, which is why my age group would go see it, and somewhat your age group would go see it, but anyone younger than that at that time didn't see the source material, so it's not going to resonate with them. The other side of that is in aesthetic and presentation, and then a lot of the humor, a lot of the references are absolutely aimed at people younger than Pat. Pat's at like the top of that age group, and Everyone younger than him was supposed to get it, but none of those people know who the fucking Pussycats are. They don't know, Pat. They don't know. Most people, you know, just under your age and a lot younger, they're not as, I mean, they know, they might be aware of Archie as sort of a cultural touchstone, but they're not reading Archie comics. They certainly didn't watch the cartoon, more than likely.
No, they think Ripperdale is like actually how this went.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, those people who have now grown up to be adults probably watch the Riverdale show and CW, and one, don't know that this is based on a cartoon or a comic strip, but two, like, that's what they think Archie is, or the modern stuff, like where Jughead's a zombie or some shit. Yeah,
not the guy who, in order to sleep in class, closed his eyes and painted eyes on his eyelids to fool Mr. Weatherby.
Right, no.
That's my Jughead.
We have to make everything dark and gritty. So Jughead's a man-eating zombie. Anyway, I think that's my major problem with this movie, because the movie is fun. The girls are gorgeous. The music is great. The movie is more or less pretty funny. The problem is it doesn't know what it wants to be. It's not serving a particular master. It is trying to be two different things to two different audiences, two different age groups, and that's where the film, I think, becomes muddled. I like the idea of, like, they're mocking, like, product placement a lot. I think Alexis said to me, like, they show this movie in colleges now to explain, like, to teach product placement or whatever. And it's funny because they're making fun of it because it's so blatant. There's a lot of parodying the music industry. There's a joke in here about Behind the Music, which for you kids,
I love the one on Leif Garrett.
they
the one we all remember. So
right, well, if Behind the Music was always like these tragic tales. You're like, oh, and we killed poor what's his face from Metallica in the van, and it was all very sad. So we placed him with Jason Newsted.
It was Dark Side of the Ring, but, you know, the music industry for those who watch us.
Everyone had a sad story.
Yeah.
It was not a happy story in Behind the Music. I used to love that show, by the way.
But Amy Grant. That was the one happy one.
Oh, sure. The Christian girl. Well, good. I once poked a badger with a fork. I sinned. Like, oh, shut up, Amy. someone got Motley Crue in here. These motherfuckers tried to summon the devil, literally. Ask Nikki Six. Anyway, my point is they did a joke in here, like we kill the bands that try that figure out what we're doing. And then we publicly tell people that they're dead, and then we do a show about it, go behind the music to cover it up.
Have you ever thought about how many rock stars die in plane crashes?
That's a great
one of the
line.
Best lines in the movie.
Yeah. I asked you about like the structure of the cartoon because I was like, I distinctly remember this being very Scooby-Doo-ish. You know, there was a mystery afoot and they had to solve the mystery. You know, they were sleuthing rock stars. And yeah, sure, they're, you know, to move the plot forward, the mystery of this thing is why is this band being torn apart and who's doing it? And yeah. You know, it's all about this machine that makes the subliminal messages. It feels like a bit of a reach. This plot feels like a bit of a reach to say this is what the girls would go through in a typical episode of Josie and the Pussycats. And on the one hand, on the other hand, it's not big enough or over the top enough to make movie sense. You know, when you adapt something from the small screen or from the page to the theatric, you want to make it an event. And this almost feels too small. This almost feels like an extended episode of a live-action Josie and the Pussycat show. There's a lot of padding in this movie. I distinctly remember, like, there'd be times I was laughing, there'd be times I was following along, and then there were other times, and this has got, like, a short runtime to it. I think it's clocks
think
in
it's
at
like 91 minutes, right?
98 minutes, yeah. So it's just over an hour and a half, which is fine. But it does drag in places. There's some pacing issues here. And it's because, again, I think they had a nice idea for like a 45-minute show, you know, an hour-long CW show or, you know, a 30 or 22-minute sitcom. And they had to stretch it to 90 minutes. And so there's some padding and pacing issues there. So that's kind of my thing. I think this needed another pass through editing. And, you know, let's tighten up this plot a little bit. Let's make it a little bit more like the cartoon. Let's make the stakes a little bit bigger, to make this more of an event. And let's pick an age bracket, you know, because here's the thing. If you're going to aim this at like prepubescent girls, there has to be another reason for them to see this thing because they have no relation to the Josie and the Pussycats. There has to be another way to hook them in. And if you're going to sell it to old men like me, then you really have to, like the linchpin of this thing is this has to be right off the page. So I will send it over to the defense now.
So in terms of the identity crisis that you're bringing up, in terms of it doesn't know who it's selling to,
yeah,
I will definitely highlight that in terms of the marketing as opposed to the actual film itself.
Okay.
You know, again, I was 15 at the time. You're 25 at the time this comes out. When I see that poster, I see three strikingly gorgeous women.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we already know who Tara Reid is from American Pie, obviously. We know who Rachel Lee Cook is from She's All That. We don't know. We haven't seen enough of Rosario Dawson yet because she hasn't done Crossroads with Britney Spears yet. But also one that crossed my mind. but we see her. Wow, she's great looking, too. We know who Josie and the Pussycats are. Okay, they're going to be they're going to wear the costumes? What? Yes, sold. That's what it takes for a 15-year-old boy to, you know, want to go see this movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah. If you're ever wondering what a 15-year-old boy wants, it's a girl in a cat suit with a tail and her legs showing.
Pretty much, especially girls who look like this. Like, good lord.
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, there's no wrong answer. Who's your favorite? You know.
Who's your favorite? Yes.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, just you know, and again, right there, you have that part of the audience, okay?
Yeah.
Now, you're trying to rope in, and again, we always think bigger picture. When you do something that's family entertainment, you generally get the idea of, oh, you're getting, you know, at least two tickets instead of one because you have to have a parent with the kid to go see the movie. Is it just seeing a movie that, you know, the parent's going to go to?
Right.
Again, the problem is the last time this franchise had any, you know, geared towards children, it was like 1971.
Right.
You know, there wasn't
born yet.
Right. There was no updated, you know, version of this cartoon. the way Scooby-Doo got, you know, 85 different iterations right. through the years. Yogi Bear got 85 different iterations through the years.
Right.
There was none of that for Josie and the Pussycats. You had the reruns on Cartoon Network if you had cable TV, and if you happened to be watching it at the specific time they played the show.
Right, and not to mention the fact that just because you throw it on Cartoon Network doesn't mean anyone's watching.
Yeah, it's not like they were tracking the ratings for this to see what it was doing, you know, versus whatever new Saturday morning cartoons were coming out at the time. You know, they weren't really heavily looking at, hey, I wonder how this is skewing versus Pokemon, you know? Like, that's not something that was on their minds.
There's no video game, by the way. You want to sell to a kid now, you throw a skin into Fortnite, apparently, and I felt myself die saying that out loud. But I'll tell you, you want to reach my son and his friends who are all with the headsets and the yelling of obscenities. They're playing Fortnite. And if it's in Fortnite, then he has to run and tell me about it. So, like, if Josie the Pussycat shows up... if Josie and the Pussycat shows up at, you know, at a USO show in Call of Duty, you know, sure. Yeah, now you got something. But they did none of those things.
No, there was no, you know, exterior marketing really for this in terms of crossover kind of merchandising. I don't believe there was a video game of any kind. Maybe I'm wrong. If they did, they probably did it for, you know, a system nobody had, like, you know, some kind of Game Boy iteration.
Well, I was going to say.
There definitely wasn't one for PlayStation, I can tell you that.
Well, if this is 2001, I don't think we're doing Guitar Hero or Rock Band just yet.
We are not yet, no.
Right.
But so, you know,
a Josie and the Pussycats adaptation of Rock Band? Oh, that would have been fantastic.
I mean, again, you know, you could put the letters to Cleo stuff in there.
Sure.
But again, the identity crisis is more to do with the marketing than the filmmaking itself. And I think that's problematic. Again, you know, this movie, if you're trying to market it towards the preteen, you know, groups, they ain't going to get it.
Yeah.
Nothing in here is going to make sense to them. They're not going to get the callbacks to the show generally because they don't watch it or haven't watched it. They're not going to get the wink nudge product placement stuff all throughout the movie because they're too young to understand that concept.
I actually think that's a brilliant point, though. Like, a lot of this movie, and that's why I stress the word satire, this is a satire of the music industry. Now, go poll your 10-year-old girls in your life and ask them what they know about the music industry enough that they're going to get the satire.
And again, just corporate culture as a whole. Not even, right. Now, obviously, we're funneling that into the music industry specifically in this movie, but it really is a knock on corporate culture as a whole. When you have, you know, stadiums that have, you know, it's Gillette Stadium now as opposed to, you know, what they used to call the old Foxborough Stadium, right?
Right.
And everything is a corporate sponsorship and name, American Airlines Arena, you know, everything like that. The Home Depot Center, Camping World Arena, you know.
Right. The Florida Fairgrounds Amphitheater has had five names since I moved to Florida in 2005. My favorite was the 1-800-ASK-GARY Amphitheater. That is a real thing, people. Look it up.
And you know, but this is also the charm of the movie to an audience that maybe wouldn't have paid to go see it at the time in large numbers.
Right.
Because again, if you're, you know... You know, we've covered the young teen boy demographic and why this appeals to us.
Yeah, sure.
However, on the flip side, for the girls in that same age bracket, this really isn't going to appeal to them because if they know what Josie and the Pussycats are, they're going to think they're too mature to go see this.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we all know, 15-year-old girls think they're the most mature people on earth and this is beneath them.
Yeah.
At least the ones I knew way back when. Mark, I don't know if that's the same for you, but...
Yeah, tracks.
Yeah. But, you know, that's kind of... So you're losing that part of the market, too. The older, you know, 20 crowd is not going in mass to see this, really, at this point in time, even though they're going to get the satire because it's not being marketed to them.
Right.
This is why it's become a cult film in hindsight as opposed to when it was released in theaters. I saw it in theaters, and... I'll be very honest, even at 15, like I got a lot of it, but not all of it.
Right.
And it's one of those movies that you get more of the next time you see it after you've gotten a little smarter about things.
Yeah.
The appeal of how all three of them look still stays the same for me.
Sorry.
I don't think Rachel Lee Cook ever looked better than she does in this movie. She's just, you know, wow. Like, you know, every time she's on screen, I like my heart skips a beat a little bit, and I'm just like, holy cow, Rachel Lee Cook.
Is just honestly beautiful. Don't know what's happened to Rachel Lee Cook since 2001. I couldn't tell you where she went.
I believe she is a vegan activist.
Ugh. Tara Reid, well, because I know what happened to Tara Reid. Tara Reid went right to sci-fi and started doing Sharknado movies.
Yeah, after some personal struggles, you know, we're rooting for you, Tara. We were happy to see you in Sharknado. And that Dawson girl, she's had an okay career.
Yeah, she, I think the last thing I saw her was in some heroin show. A joke. She actually is in one of the heroin shows that came out last year.
I saw her with Spartacus and worried about her.
Super. I think you made a brilliant point, though, about it's a little too dumb for the adult audience. It's a little too smart for the prepubescent audience. And I think that that's, you know, so I enjoy it now, but I'm also like nigh on 50 and I get all the jokes. And I was there at the time in 2001. And I very much knew what was happening. And so there's a lot going on in this movie that appeals to me. But I actually remember playing it for Lily and having to explain some of the jokes to her.
It's something that you look back at now, especially in the cultural climate we're in now with, you know, product placement and things of that nature, where it's just so over the top evident in everything we watch or every sporting event, every, you know, anything, you know, any award show. They're all just heavy laden with these product placement, you know, bogus things. To the point where the pharmaceutical industry has gotten in on it at this point.
Well, what I laugh about is this movie is just like, we're going to take the piss out of product placement. And a few years later, Michael Bay will make a Transformers movie. And a few years after that, Michael Bay will make a Transformers movie where, no lie, a Bud Light is drunk center frame on film. They stop the movie so that it's Mark Wahlberg. Mark Wahlberg could drink a butt. Well, literally. Like in the middle of a goddamn scene, just stops and drinks beer.
Yeah, because again, the funny part is if you read about the production of this, they didn't get paid by any of these sponsors.
No, they all put their shit in voluntarily.
Yeah, it was, you know, so you get the shit ton of Starbucks, and for whatever reason, I remember Steve Madden featuring very heavy in that. But I don't remember. That might have been around the time Steve Madden was getting arrested.
Perfect.
I think this is right before his big comeback. But yeah, so there's a lot of Steve Madden fixture in it. I can appreciate that. And you know, it's like they took the Wayne's World scene where they do the 30 seconds of, you know, product placement between Wayne and Garth with Pepsi, Pizza Hut. That's
so funny.
Which is such a great bit. Yeah. And they really just hammer that point home. But again, that's a movie being marketed, you know, to two different audiences as well.
I think you could try one more time with Josie and the Pussycats. I think you have to acknowledge that no one knows what the fuck this is. That Josie and the Pussycats, you have to rebuild that audience. I think if you wanted to do a Josie and the Pussycats movie, one, you have to make a decision right off the bat. You know,
who is this for?
Yeah. So if you're like, well, we just want like the middle-aged people, you know, 30 and above that might know what a Josie and the Pussycats is, okay, then you kind of have to make it The Runaways, you know, or Runaway. You have to do something with this to kind of to appeal to that crowd. But I think if you're going for, you know, 10-year-olds, then assume they don't know what it is, and you have to then, you know,
do Bratz an updated dolls. Version of the cartoon.
Yeah, an updated version of the cartoon and put the damn goddamn thing on TikTok because they ain't watching on terrestrial television. I'll tell you that right now. No. You throw it up on YouTube.
Yeah.
it's like an old man. Throw it on the YouTubes where the girlies be.
Netflix, whatever the hell.
Yeah. And I think then you can kind of build from there once you've re-educated your intended audience as to what the hell this thing is. And then I think double down on like the mystery part of it, because again, Josie and the Pussycats, like one of the other things I have somewhat of a problem with this movie is as much as I like music and I'm glad it's about music, I mean, it's about a band, there should be music in this thing, but that was never the focus of the cartoon either. They broke to play music, but it was almost like
the music was the ancillary part of the story.
Yeah, it was kind of almost like a cutaway or a fade out, you know.
It was used to explain why they are where they are. They have a gig in, right, you know, whatever town, and you know, in this haunted amphitheater where this ghost lurks, and they
right. Or it was like, you know, the 70s show used to do this where they would have those like interstitions where they would have like someone dancing or something on screen.
Yes.
And then they'd go to the next scene
or whatever. And
right. Yeah. And that's where the music was. It was in the central focus of the show. And I think that's kind of got to be, you know, your Josie and the Pussycats movie is they have to be involved in something that has stakes, and the music comes kind of come secondary.
Yeah.
And then market directly to your target audience about things they care about on things they watch. And then I think you got something. Pat, well,
do two versions of it, if nothing else. Like, you know, mm-hmm. when the god awful new Masters of the Universe cartoon came out, that's the worst thing that's ever happened to He-Man.
Yes, Pat.
Yeah, so bad.
Okay.
But when that came out, they had another version that was geared toward a younger audience that came out. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And, you know, those of us who grew up on He-Man loved that version, the one geared toward the younger audience.
Right.
Because it did a better job understanding of what made He-Man work in the first place. You know?
Yes.
And then you had this, you know, older audience geared show, which mm-hmm. was terrible and wasn't successful. And, you know, it is what it is. It was there.
Well, another example of this would be Aquaman. So James Wan does his big Aquaman movie. And then my son
on Max.
Yeah. And then my son and I actually reviewed it. It was that 3-episode Aquaman and it almost like fit into that movie. Like it was like that. It was like a little, you know, addendum to the movie was this like further invention of that version of Aquaman drawn by somebody doing acid. I don't understand that animation style at all.
No, but that's a great example too. I mean, mm-hmm. It was the right kind of tie-in where you're okay. We understand that if we want to reach this audience and this audience, we have to mm-hmm. do something for both that will give them an understanding of this platform and program, and then we can go into something where we can try to get everybody.
Yeah. Last couple of things. Just you know, this isn't like the most formal of On Trials ever. We're just kind of Pat and I are buddies. We're just shooting the shit. Parker Posey is so good in Lost in Space as the villain. Like David and I we love the show, and when we say the high points, we're like the highest of high points was Parker Posey on that show, and here she plays such a silly over the top villain, but she's so good. Like Parker Posey is one of the best parts of this movie.
Parker Posey as a Fiona, like mm-hmm. she kind of just, you know, she completely understands what this is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Probably better than anybody else in the movie. And because her character is so, you know, over the top and very much a cartoon character operating in a real world scenario,
mm-hmm.
you have to hit certain notes a certain way when you do it.
Right.
You know, when she starts reverting to the stutter, when she's having a conversation with Josie and mm-hmm. says, I start taking my teeth. You know, mm-hmm. Just her comic timing is right on. For whatever reason, she understood where to hit those beats.
Yeah, and weirdly, she elicits empathy from the audience. Like, you're supposed to be rooting against her. You want Josie to win. But then she goes into her thing, and you're just like, I kind of feel bad for you. Oh.
And then we were also talking, you know, a little bit about Stooges earlier. And, mm-hmm. you know, physical comedy and that how that plays in.
Yeah.
Her reactionary and her facials and mm-hmm. just her body language, she's doing everything she can to elevate this stuff off the page. And it's really wonderful.
We talk sometimes, it's probably the last point I'm going to make, and you have the final word, about we watch some of these movies and no one looks like they're having any fun. You know, it's just, you know, everyone feels like they're at gunpoint or we're just kind of going through the motions. Like, you know, let's get this shit done. Everyone looked like they were having a ball with this thing. You know, whether it succeeded or failed, I'm sure everyone wanted it to succeed, obviously. But I think, like, I wouldn't necessarily say they walked in and it was a passion project. I'm sure it was, for a lot of people, it was just a job. On the other hand, once they were there and they saw what they had in their hands, they were like, no, no, this is awesome. I'm all in. And you feel it. You feel the energy of the movie. Like, even just watching it now, you know, 24 years later, 23 years later, I still get the sense that everyone had a ball with this thing and was sorely disappointed when it did not make money.
I probably wouldn't have been able to keep a straight face at any point if I was sharing a scene with Alan Cumming.
Oh, he's great in this.
Yeah, just really chewing into the scenery and everything around mm-hmm. him. He was fantastic. Again, even the leads, right? Okay, obviously Melody, we talked about, is the comic relief, plays the part perfectly, like she's ripped out of there. To give gravity to the characters of Josie and Val in this kind of environment really says a lot about how good Rachel Lee Cook and Rosario Dawson were in this.
Yes. So I have one thing about the movie I just wanted to make a comment on as a metal fan. So they killed DeZor in a plane crash, but oh wait, DeZor was alive. And the way they explained it was like, well, we crashed and survived the plane crash, but unfortunately we landed at a Metallica show and they beat the shit out of us. And I was playing for my son. Oh God, who's the comedian with the high eyes that used to be on SNL? He's a big metal fan.
Pete Davidson.
Not Pete Davidson. I can't remember his name. He did the Goat Boy.
Jim Brewer,
yeah. So I was playing him some Jim Brewer, and Jim Brewer is telling a story about how he's married now and he doesn't go to concerts, but he was able to get out of the house with his wife once. Apparently it was the Big Four, which he doesn't tell the audience, because I'm guessing he doesn't think the audience knows what the Big Four is. But for those of you that don't know or are playing the home game, the Big Four was a
thrash metal
concert event.
Yeah.
It was headlined by Metallica, and the Big Four of thrash are Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, and Anthrax. And so they did, first it was just a one-time event, like pay-per-view show, which I actually took Melissa to go see at the movies when it came out. But then they actually toured it around for a little bit. So I guess Jim Brewer took his wife to go see the Big Four, and they didn't know what they were getting themselves into, because they were just going, they just think they're going to a Metallica show. Good old-fashioned Nancy Reagan, apple pie, simple Metallica show. Neglect to understand that Slayer is there, and Slayer brings their Sons of Anarchy looking, you know, fucking
Hell's Angels, pagans, whatever. Yeah.
Oh God, what are the Running Man? The guys from the Running Man.
Oh God, the ones the criminals that are hunting down Arnold.
Yeah, they had a specific name, like the Walkers or Pursuers or something.
Yeah.
They called Jesse Ventura one of the
Captain Freedom.
That's right. I'm not doing it. Anyway. So I played this for Jonas, this Jim Brewer bit, where he talks about, like, we heard a rumbling when Slayer came on, and he was like, just stay with me, you'll be okay. And the rumbling gets louder, and Slayer plays, and Jim Brewer just looks at his wife and goes, well, lots of luck, honey, every man for himself. Having been to a dozen Slayer shows, I knew exactly what he meant. I've never gotten my ass kicked harder. Which is fine. It's what you go for. So I'm playing this for my 10-year-old son, Jonas, and he's just like, I don't understand. Like, I get that Slayer's a heavy metal band, but all the stuff you listen to is heavy metal. Like, why are they different? So he's in the car with me the other day, and I'm playing for him the song Disciple from the album God Hates Us All. And he goes, oh, that's why Jim Brewer almost died. Got
it. The light went on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now he made the connection. I say all that to say the joke in the movie is we got the shit beat us by Metallica fans. And I was like, I get they couldn't say Slayer because that's really who they were talking about, because no Metallica fans aren't beating up NSYNC fans.
Well, Saint Anger hadn't come out yet.
True. God, what an awful album that is.
Also, Metallica was pretty universally hated at this point for the Napster fiasco.
Was that 2001 or was that later?
I think it was 2000, but I mean, obviously okay. This movie's in production in 2000. So,
okay.
Again, it's a timely reference to that point in time.
Right. Well, this is my nerdy moment. This is the moment where I would push me into the locker and say, shut up, you nerd. But it's like, Metallica fans aren't that violent.
No. They're honestly, Metallica has more of the like pussy fans of metal than I've ever seen.
They really do.
Yeah.
Metallica is the Taylor Swift of metal.
They really are. once hair metal died out, like yeah. They were the ones who retained the guys who didn't really like metal. Not to go off on a side tangent. But
like, all the poison
the guys heading to a locker. Poison fan. Then it was, listen, Metallica, you pussy. Put on a Pantera record.
All the Poison fans migrated to Metallica. Yeah. Like, oh, we're still cool.
Yeah.
And then Pantera came out and kicked everyone's ass.
Everybody comes in looking like Kerry King and just beats the hell out of everybody.
Like, am I at a neo-Nazi convention? No, it's a Pantera show.
But yeah, again, they you know, we get the joke.
Yeah, sure.
You know, we're in the niche audience. We're a little more.
That is the casual. Only band they could have referenced where that joke makes any sense. That the audience would have known who the hell it is. It's like we land, you know, we crashed, we survived the plane crash, but we landed in an anal cunt show. Who? You know, you can't. Because also that would have, they would have died. See, but you can't say anal cunt and Josie and the Pussycats.
No, you can't.
No. But speaking of anal cunts, anything else, Pat Mullen?
So that as far as the if you want to get nitpicky, they do play around with the characters of Alan, who in mm-hmm. the cartoon and comics was a very big, hunky, you know, yeah. manly man, even though he wore an ascot.
Didn't they all back then?
They really did. Very much the Fred of the group, if sure. you will. Yeah, they turn him into a little sissy boy here.
Yeah. Again, I'm sure that's an executive note.
It is, going, and also at this point in time,
we want the young pretty girls, and the young pretty girls, like, you know, boys.
Well, again, at this point in time, we didn't really have manly men in movies anymore. True. We really just had the young sissy boys.
Yep. Gosh, so even sense. Even Chris Evans, who's going to grow up to be Captain America and look awesome, you know, was in one of them big sissy boy movies.
Sure was, and you know, was a skinny little sissy boy looking guy. And
yes, he was,
because they were very in at this point in time. Mark Wahlberg mm-hmm. was a little bit skinny and a little bit sissy looking back then, before he mm-hmm. you know, started working out at 4 a.m. after 2 hours of morning prayers at 2 a.m. and you know,
drinking beers in Transformers movies.
Yeah, yeah, but again, you know,
we arm.
Yeah, and again, if you look at the music industry at this time and who the popular mm-hmm. male artists were, oh, yeah. I love me some John Mayer. I think he's great, but mm-hmm. he was kind of the archetype of what they wanted guys in the music industry to look like. Very right. skinny, you know, skinny jean wearing, acoustic guitar playing types.
A few weeks ago, we were talking about Justin Timberlake, and I was joking around with Jason about it because he's in Black Snake Moan. And I'm like, look, Black Snake Moan is like one of my favorite movies. It's a great movie, and Justin Timberlake is fine in it. But much like Tom Cruise and Jack Reacher, I don't buy him as a badass.
Yeah, there's he was in that, like, he's one of those guys that you can't ever, I'm sorry, no matter mm-hmm. what you think he can do or whatever, he's a great mm-hmm. he's a great entertainer, but putting him in a movie like that or trying to have him play a tough guy, an alpha dog, like,
yeah, no, please I mean, stop. when he later on in the movie, when he cries and has a panic attack, yes, that I can see Justin Timberlake doing, and I guess that's what they hired him. But when he's got to, like, threaten Samuel Jackson with a gun, no sir. Samuel Jackson walks up and bites the gun.
Yeah, he's the Sami Zayn of the movie Tough Guys.
Like, five people listening got that reference.
That's okay, because they're the ones who need to get it.
All right. Anything else, Pat?
Again, in hindsight, I think this movie has become more of a cult fixture because people have understood it as time went on. Yeah. It's a movie that wasn't made, like you said, for any particular audience at that point in time. And that was its biggest misstep, because I don't think it was an overly expensive production, especially by today's standards. Good Lord.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. It wasn't made for fucking Marvel money. No, yeah. This thing came in on a paltry $39 million budget.
But it bombed, right?
Yeah. It only made about $15 million.
Yeah. See, so that inherently was its biggest flaw, is as because it's not a poorly crafted movie. Okay, yeah, no. There are parts in the middle that drag and could have used a beater here or there to speed things up. You mm-hmm. know, the characterizations are pretty well done. Again, everybody seems like they're having a good time making the movie. That's not really transparent in what we see on screen. It's, you know, it comes through very organically. And I think it's a lot of fun, and I think it's a brilliant fucking movie. And especially as somebody who is very much into conspiracy theories, RFK and Jesse in 2024, everybody. as somebody who's very into stuff like that and knows a little bit of a thing or two about the inner workings of the music business, this was very fun now to see, especially. Yeah. And again, it's a self-aware movie. It doesn't take itself too seriously about these things. It pokes a lot of fun at itself, which is great. Good. Be aware of how silly you're being, but also at the same time, make a point. It does. And I love it. I think it's a movie that's aged remarkably well along the lines of like Predator 2, which may be the best aged movie of all time. And Robert and I have had that discussion many times.
I was going to say, not to go off on a tangent, but the problem with Predator 2 was everyone wanted a second Predator movie, and instead they got a new Predator.
Yeah.
That's really the only thing that's wrong with it, because Predator 2 is fucking awesome.
Yeah, Predator 2 rules.
It's just not like Predator 1.
Yeah, it's a different movie. And you know what? Good, because it was never going to live up to Predator 1 if they tried to make the same movie again.
Right. Not even if they stick an Indian girl in it and call it Prey.
Yeah. Anyway.
Welcome to Snarks R Us. All right, Pat. So that is it. That is our review of Josie and the Pussycats. I'm glad that we spent an hour on this. You know, again, I if we had done it as a triple feature, we would have had to cut short the review. But I think we had a nice, long, fun conversation. And, it, you know, the hour went by really, really fast. So I'm glad we did it.
There's good stuff that came out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not unhappy that it worked out this way. All right. When are you back? Because I know that
if I know nothing else, I know cartoons.
Shut up. All right. Yeah, you'll have to be back in about a month from now to the day. And OK, so let me quick tell what happened here, because people listening now don't know what happened. So about a month ago, Pat, Ronnie, and I did High Schools in Trouble movies. And it was the big ones, you know, Lean on Me, Stand and Deliver, and Dangerous Minds. And when I asked, you know, very innocently, why are we doing this? Pat, Ronnie shoves me into the pool and goes, because Pat wanted to do the substitute. You wouldn't let him. I'm like, Jesus Christ. So again, because I accommodate people, I am a friend to everyone.
I mean, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
I said, well, we'll get it in there. Jesus, Mary and Joseph. So in a month from now, myself and Pat's lawyer, Ronnie Adams, we'll be doing another high school.
Adams, Adams, and Schwartz.
Yes. We're doing another High School's in Trouble. But this is the fun one, Pat.
Yeah.
This is the fun one. This is the all Pat, all day long triple feature. The Substitute, The Principal, and 187.
Oh.
I have not seen any of these. I might have seen 187, but I have definitely not seen The Principal. I would
be very shocked if you didn't see 187.
Yeah, no, I think I've seen everything involving its black guy in the street ever.
You're very down, so I would be hard-pressed to believe you didn't see 187.
Yeah, I'm 90% certain I did.
Having never seen The Principal, I get it. It was a sleeper. But I'm also surprised you've never seen The Substitute.
Because I can't take that movie seriously. That's
you're not supposed to.
That's James Jim Belushi, right?
No, the principal is Jim Belushi.
Okay,
who's the substitute? Is Tom Berenger.
Oh, I can tell you, I definitely didn't see it then, because I vaguely remember the Jim Belushi one and going no, just no. I was already out on this genre, as I said in the last podcast. I sure as fuck wasn't gonna watch that one.
Well, two words for you then, Mark: no more.
Okay, I can't wait to talk about these. Look, I'm just going to say this now on this podcast for whoever's listening. Anytime I get somebody on here who's actually excited to talk about what we're talking about, I'm all for it. I don't even give a shit what it is. So Pat's like, we're gonna watch 9 hours of lumberjacks throwing trees. Okay, as long as you're excited about this.
Dude, the take Taylor Swift's the fucking best. Oh, my God.
I know. That's why I use that example. All right. In the meantime, in between time, so that's when Pat's going to be up on the show next, April 18th, The Substitute, The Principal, and 187, yo. In the meantime, in between time, this past
week... Is that when I talk about The Crow?
What now? No. Behave. I don't want to talk about The Crow. This past Sunday was a rescheduled show. Me and Sean did a On Trial for The Great Gatsby. And then on Monday, myself and Jesse, Robert Cooper was helping Mexicans illegally cross the border, so he couldn't make it. But myself and Jesse did Ministry Hopium for the Masses. That was a fun show. And then Tuesday, we talked about Pat's favorite thing, cartoons, modern cartoons, that is. It's Zach Strobel, Alexis Haina, and myself, Robert Winfrey. We did Kung Fu Panda 4. Next week, we've got No Damn You Hollywood, but lots of television. Myself, Ronnie, and Jesse, the band's back together, and we're going to talk Sons of Anarchy Season 2, featuring Henry Rollins. Hey, so, you know, I've been trying to get my son to do more karaoke, right? But I always get him to do weird songs, like Detachable Penis. So I said, hey, here's one for you. Here's one I think you can do. I played Liar by the Rollins Band for him. Which, after you've been...
I can't help but think he was doing the Beavis and Butthead version of it, where it's just Beavis going, Liar! And it's not even that song that's playing. I think they were listening to Ghost Rider from The Crow, ironically enough.
So two things about listening to Liar by the Rollins Band. One, after the few years of that I've been through, that song has never resonated with me more. Like, I totally get the song now. Okay.
I mean,
I see you, Henry. I see you. And then my son going, I can't, like, this song is great, Dad. I understand why you like it. Trust me, I understand why you like it. But this is a little cringe for a 10-year-old. I'm like, all right, that's fair.
Yeah, maybe start him on One or something else, you know.
Metallica?
One by, by Rollins Band.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Sons of Anarchy Season 2 starring Henry Rollins, which is fantastic. And then Star Trek Lower Decks Season 4 with David Wright, not starring Henry Rollins. And then Thursday, myself and Sean Comer will be doing a triple feature, a director focus on Jim Jarmusch. We are looking at Coffee and Cigarettes, Ghost Dog, and The Dead Don't Die. And this is really only so that I can talk at length about Bill Murray at a diner, drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes with the Wu-Tang Clan.
I mean, I love Ghost Dog, so.
Everyone does. It's going to be the center poster in that triple feature. All right. You don't have any plugs, right? You don't have any other podcasts that you're doing?
No, I'm doing
Jiu-Jitsu. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm doing The Crow, and I'm doing X-Men 97, and I'm doing Moana 2, and Aquaman 2, and Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Yes, sir. Oh, we're definitely doing Breaking 2. There's a triple feature. Crush Groove, Breaking, and Breaking 2.
Wasn't there another, like, a loose sequel to Breaking 2? I'm not even kidding, and it's with Ice-T, his character from those movies, but he's the only one.
You talking about Crush Groove?
No, because Crush Groove was the one. That's the Russell Simmons story, essentially, right?
Yeah, I believe so. There really is a Breaking 2 Electric Boogaloo.
No, I'm aware of that. But Ice-T's character from that, if I'm not mistaken, actually got, like, a spinoff.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah, I'm looking it up right now. I swear to God.
Is it surviving the game?
There's a third, you know.
Breaking movie?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Dude, how about Disorderlies with the Fat Boys?
Oh, my God. And Ralph Bellamy?
Yes.
So great.
Oh, my God. We need to put together a triple feature of, like, House Party, Disorderlies, and another 80s, mid-90s rap movie.
The sequel to Breaking 2 is called Rappin'.
Perfect.
Rappin' has a plot unconnected to the previous two films and features different lead characters and locations.
Oh, excellent. I would absolutely.
Stars Mario Van Peebles, Kadeem Hardison. Who else do we know?
What an all-star cast that is.
Eric LaSalle. The Force MDs are in this.
Oh, the Force MDs, you say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Honestly, we're just going to watch House Party now.
I told the woman, so I can't remember why I said, I started naming everybody in my office after different old rappers because one of the women I work with, her last name sounds a lot like Shock G from Digital Underground.
Yeah.
So I started calling her Shock G, and I was just like, all right, everyone. And then there's another guy who, because there's two different people with the same last name. So we started calling him his first initial, then last name, and his first initial was B. And I'm just like, B Smith. All right, it sounds too much like B Real. So we got Shock G, we got B Real, and then I just started giving everybody a rapper name.
Yeah, they're Dougie Fresh is over there.
Oh yeah,
Tresh is over there.
So the one specific girl, I pointed at her, and she's like, "Well, what rapper am I?" And I'm like, "You're the real Roxanne." What a reference that was! And then I had to tell her there's an actual Netflix movie about the real Roxanne called Roxanne. Roxanne.
So now are you either Everlast or maybe MC Search?
Oh my God, Pat, Pop Goes the Weasel, and the Weasel Goes Pop. No, I'm Chuck D. It takes a nation of millions to hold me back. All right, I'm done now.
Prime Minister Pete Nice.
You are totally Prime Minister Pete Nice.
I did. His dad was the president of my high school. So,
and if anybody in the Rattle Legend Broadcasting Network is Flavor Flav, it's Jason Teasley. Just blah. Yeah,
that checks out, actually.
Just jumping in frame with the top hat, making no sense. Yeah. All right. Well, folks, Jason Teasley is Flavor Flav is the phrase that pays here on the Rattle Legend Broadcasting Network. So I think we're done here. All right. Court is now in recess for Pat Mullen, who we should talk boxing again real soon, Pat. I miss talking boxing with you.
We were going to do our heavyweight series, and then the world exploded, and it is what it is. We'll figure it out.
We'll figure out something to do when in May when Tyson Fury fights Alexander Usyk.
We're not here to beg or shuffle. We're just here to do the heavyweight shuffle.
Ladies and gentlemen, for Pat Mullen, who's rapping and clapping, I'm your mandated reporter, Mark Rattledge. Be well, be safe, and behave.